Good evening, everyone. Okay, this week I'm talking about monuments and ruins, surrealism and archaeology in the New World, that is, in the Americas. But I'm starting with a side, which in a sense is what I'm not going to be talking about. This is, on the left, stone chacmool at the bottom, sculpture from the Toltec city of Tula, and above it a fragment of one of the serpent walls from Tula. And beside that, Henry Moore's reclining nude from 1929 at Leeds City Art Gallery. And, of course, he famously based that reclining figure on a chacmool that is in the British Museum, which is obviously not the one at Tula, but is very similar to it. That is, a figure lying on its back, clasping something on its front. Now, this is very interesting, but this is in a way, not actually the kind of thing I'm going to be addressing today, but I want to make it my starting point in a slightly negative way. William Rubin organised an exhibition called Primitivism in 20th Century Art in 1984. This was a monumental and stunning exhibition visually, but it was quite controversial in its approach to the problem of what constitutes the primitive, what constitutes the primitive that inspired the primitivism of the 20th century artists. Now, in an effort to enforce a stylistic coherence to this slippery and value-laden term, Rubin decided to distinguish what he called pre-Columbian court styles, such as the Aztec, Olmec, and Inca, from tribal art, that is, African, Oceanian, northwest coast of America, Eskimo, and so on. And I quote, "In their style, character, and implications, the pre-Columbian court and theocratic arts of Mesoamerica and South America should be grouped with the Egyptian, Javanese, and Persian. They could no longer, in his view, be called primitive, although, of course, they had been in the 19th century. So this led to an exclusion in his catalogue of, for example, a discussion of Henry Moore's transformation of the Toltec chacmool in his reclining figures. And in fact, only Rosalind Krauss in the exhibition catalogue defied the interdiction not to talk about pre-Columbian civilizations and firmly discussed Giacometti in relation to Mesoamerican art and to Bataille's ideas of the primitive. Well, I'm not primarily concerned with the formal borrowings and the visible affinities between the modern and the non-Western artists, fascinating as it is, but rather with the critical movement of thought in the context of surrealism that placed new values on non-Western societies. This took different forms, from aesthetic appreciation of the objects right through to the scholarly research into the art and literature of the lost civilizations of the Americas. And the surrealists themselves took, of course, no notice of the distinction that Rubin draws between the pre-Columbian civilizations and tribal art. And they were just as interested in great statues like this Aztec Coatlicue, which I shall come back to again, as in the masks of the northwest coast. With the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939, many of the surrealists went as refugees to America. Breton, Ernst, Matter, and Duchamp to New York, Perret, Remedios Varo, Wolfgang, Alice Palin, and Leonora Carrington, among others, to Mexico. And this led to an intensification of their interest in and knowledge of the indigenous and pre-Columbian civilizations, as well as their acquisitions. And I'm going to divide this talk into two parts. The first part I'm just going to be looking at quite broadly at their what they exhibited and what they acquired in the 20s and 30s. And then I'm going to be looking at the wartime experience in the 1940s. And there will be a brief interlude in the middle on European ruins. In the first Surrealist Manifesto, André Breton conjures up a place where he and his friends live and work, a castle that is not necessarily all in ruins. The Surrealists never made a secret of their taste for the darker side of Romanticism, for the Gothic and its uncanny, for a past where the marvellous took different forms, and where past and present come together in a flash. And I want to look briefly at this collage by Max Ernst as an example of the, as it were, the dissolution of historical periods, the appearance of the Sphinx beside a railway carriage with the bird-headed man in it. It's an extraordinary collage made in 19th century engravings. And Ernst also frequently included Easter Island statues in his collages. And I quote from Breton's preface to Max Ernst's La Femme sans tête. He describes Ernst's collages as veritable slits in time, space, customs, and even beliefs. History itself, he writes, falls outside like snow. Breton links the disorientation and displacements produced by Ernst's magnificently haunted brain, among other things, to statues. And he says that in order to be truly displaced, the statue had to have once lived in a conventional statue-like statue life, in a conventional statue place. So the artists treated the past and treated other civilizations with great freedom. At the same time, the Surrealist poets and writers very often did considerable research onto the myths and onto the sort of societies and cultures of pre-Columbian America. One of the very early exhibitions at the Galerie Surrealiste in Paris in 1927, the gallery had opened in 1925, was of Yves Tanguy and American objects. And one of the sculptures reproduced in the catalogue and that was on show there is a version of the Coatlicue. It's given a different name, Deum Michi, but you can see it is based on the same form, which is it's basically an accumulation of ideas associated with a particular deity, the so-called earth goddess. She of the serpent skirt, and the figure is wearing a serpent skirt. She is wearing a necklace of hands and hearts. At the centre there is, you can see, I think, a skull, and the head is two serpents which rise out of the neck. In a sense, the sculpture, we'll see it in more detail a little later on, is actually incorporating several aspects of the myth of the birth of the Aztec god Huitzilopochtli. Now, there were other objects there from British Columbia, New Mexico, Mexico, Colombia, and Peru from the Surrealist collections. It's interesting to look at the Tanguy. This is an example of a 1927 Tanguy called a large painting, which is also a landscape. I don't think the Surrealists were trying to make any particular connection, but they were talking really about the imagination and the potential to create new landscapes, like these strange landscapes of Tanguys, which are very often unclear about whether you're underwater or whether there's any sort of division between the different elements, between the sky and the earth and the water. And the creatures in them, which often cast shadows, are in a sense themselves sort of invented objects. In 1931, there was a very large sale of the collections of Breton and Éluard. Now, this was the same year as the enormous colonial exhibition in Paris. Now, the Surrealists were involved with the French Communist Party in mounting a campaign against the colonial exhibition. They distributed a tract called Don't Visit the Colonial Exhibition. But at the same time, I'm afraid that they did take advantage of the interest to sell their collections. And here you can see on the left some of the Haider masks from Breton's collection, other objects from the northwest coast. And on the right, the right-hand page, top left, it's not very easy to see, but it's a tiny little Olmec figure that is from one of the earliest of the civilizations on the Gulf coast of Mexico. There's also a Costa Rican figure and various other things. There were over 300 objects in this sale in 1931. So they've been collecting very very actively for the previous 5 or 6 years. And the anti-colonial demonstration took place. There was a pamphlet, and there was also an exhibition from which these two photographs are taken, which attempt, in a sense, to reverse the notion of the fetish of the colonial culture that was being celebrated in the big exhibition, and it was attacking French colonial policy, and also, in a sense, as I say, reversing the gaze and labelling European products like the Virgin and Child in the left-hand side as European fetishes. And there's a placard, a people that oppresses others can never itself be free. And the Syrians were very, very active in their political opposition to French colonial policy. Now, the first major exhibition of pre-Columbian art in Paris took place in 1928, accompanied by a flurry of publications, including this one. It's a special issue edition of the Cahiers, which anticipates with an essay by Georges Bataille called L'Amérique disparue, Vanished or Extinct America. And I quote, "The life of the civilized peoples of America before Columbus is prodigious, for never anywhere on the globe has a bloodier eccentricity been devised by human madness." Bataille notes that historians have been struck by the hideous and grotesque forms taken by gods like Tezcatlipoca, and were thoroughly disconcerted by it. Bataille detected, as well as the terror, a kind of black humour. This is Tezcatlipoca from the Borgia screenfold, and he is take the entire lecture, but he is entirely surrounded by the 20 signs which constitute the calendar and other forms of counting in Mexico. It's a very complicated, extremely fine page from one of the very few surviving screenfolds in Mexico. So Bataille was hypnotized by heart sacrifice and by the joyful celebration of death in a city, as he says, as beautiful as Venice, its altars covered in flowers. Bataille dismisses both romantic admiration for the formal aesthetic brilliance and originality of pre-conquest civilizations and nerveless ethnographic studies in favor of the recreation of a violent world in which horror had an astonishingly cheerful character. And I quote, "Mexico was not only the most flowing of human abattoirs, but also a rich city, a veritable Venice, with canals, painted temples, and very beautiful flower gardens." So the Aztec capital, Tenochtitlan, combined slaughterhouse and flowery luxury. It is not difficult to see here the origin of Bataille's document dictionary entry on abattoir, in which he contrasts the original temples of all religions, really, as places which, with sacrifices, saw both killing and religious ritual. And he contrasts that with the contemporary fear of blood and violence, and the way that present-day abattoirs are quarantined well away from city centres. Not only, therefore, were the Aztecs able to confront death with joy, but acted it all the time as spectacle for the pleasure of their gods, such as Tezcatlipoca. And this is a page from another screen, a post-conquest screenfold, but which was reproduced in the magazine Din, which I shall come back to, and it shows a victim of heart sacrifice lying over what is actually a place sign. But this is the kind of thing Bataille is talking about. Bataille even suggests that the Aztec succumbed so swiftly to the Spanish conquest because it was like the final act of this repeated sacrificial performance. Now, his essay clearly has more to do with Bataille's own state of mind, with the struggle of a religious sensibility in a godless world, than with any historical accuracy. He was enthralled as well as repelled by the heart sacrifices, and following the document period, actually formed a small group around the Revue Acéphale, which discussed the possibility of sacrifice in the modern world. Broadly, though, Bataille's article belongs to the debate of the time among archaeologists and ethnologists around the question of the extinction or survival of pre-Columbian civilizations. And I just want to refer to another essay from the same issue of Cahiers by Alfred Metraux, who's a very distinguished ethnographer, but who at this time, 1928, was only in his early 20s, but he lays out this question very succinctly. And I quote, "The destruction of the former American civilizations was rapid and brutal, but in many respects partial. The Spanish wiped out the ruling classes, exterminated the clergy, destroyed the towns and temples, burnt the manuscripts, and broke the idols. But the American earth has preserved the pottery, cloth, art objects, and simple tools. The most beautiful buildings have survived, though derelict, and they have resisted earthquakes. As archaeological studies develop, and these remains accumulate in museums, the day will come when they will allow us to reconstruct the early history of the American continent. Perhaps we will also be able to penetrate what is still mysterious about the flowering of the great empires of Mexico, Central America, and the Andes. The conditions for the study of the American past," Metraux wrote, "are better than for European prehistory. The ruins of the great civilizations were still inhabited less than 400 years ago. There's a vast literature in Spanish, and even the books of the Mexicans and Maya. The Mexican books are in the process of being deciphered, but so far all attempts to read the Maya hieroglyphs have been in vain." Well, he's writing in 28, and when I first started working on pre-Columbian art and teaching it in Essex, which is back in the early 70s, there was still only a very partial knowledge of Mayan hieroglyphic writing. And I've kept this page up because on the left there is a drawing from one of the Mayan stele showing a block of hieroglyphs down the right-hand side and at the top. And now they are almost completely deciphered. And as a result, our picture of Mayan civilization, of the classic Mayan civilization of the first millennium, has completely transformed. We even have the names of artists. We have the names of the rulers. We have details of governance, in a sense, of the Maya area. So it's the whole picture, in that sense, which Metraux foresaw, has indeed been transformed by research. And actually, the Mexican, only four of the books, the codices, the painted books with the inscriptions, have survived out of libraries and libraries of Mayan books. And very, very few also of the Mexican books have survived. And they are actually proving in some ways more difficult to decipher than the Mayan ones. And what about today's inhabitants of America? Going back to Metraux again, quoting Metraux, "People usually think they disappeared, exterminated by the Spaniards, or absorbed in the new race that formed after the conquest. Nothing," he says, "could be further from the truth. There are still Aztecs, Maya, and Peruvians who speak the languages of their ancestors." Now, for the surrealists and for the ethnologists and historians in the 20s and 30s, the question of the continuity from the apparently lost civilizations of the Americas and the present-day inhabitants was an absorbing possibility, and one that informed both the archival research of Benjamin Perret and the wilder romantic ideals of Antonin Artaud. an actor, Antonin Artaud, who by this point had really split with the Surrealists, but who always remained in on the fringes of the movement. He arrived in Mexico in February 1936. And in July, he wrote in the Mexican newspaper El Nacional, "So, I have my idea of the Maya culture, the Toltec culture, the Zapotec culture. What interests me now is to find again in Mexico, today, the lost soul of those cultures and their survival, as much in the way of life of the people as of those who govern them." While he was in Mexico City, Artaud wrote and lectured to earn some money. He was actually extremely poor. And he met the painter Maria Izquierdo, who used to feed him, and whose work he then championed. And this is her gouache called Allegory of Work, 1936. Now, commentators have been quick to emphasize Artaud's disappointment at finding only the corpse of European culture in Mexico. But this wasn't quite the whole story. Writing about Izquierdo in August 1936, his desire to find the lost Indian soul colors his understanding of Izquierdo's paintings. He was yet to make his fateful visit to the land of the Tarahumaras and to experience the peyote ceremony, and there's still controversy about whether he actually did or whether he took his description of it from another ethnographer. But he certainly went to the Tarahumaras, and he wrote a book called The Voyage to the Tarahumaras. So he came to Mexico in search of indigenous art. He thought that rather than witnessing the resurrection of the old world, he was seeing its final end. All he found were imitations of European art, with one exception, the painting of Maria Izquierdo, which has a truly Indian inspiration. But her painting, although spontaneous, he says, is not pure. It's often influenced also by Europe and modernity. And I think you can very clearly see here that she has been very interested in William Blake. And she sort of borrows these great striding legs from Blake's watercolours and the reference, I think, to a cosmos. But the ruins and the volcanoes and the woman, certainly Artaud thought, belong very much to Mexico. He was deeply moved to encounter, as he put it, naked indigenous figures trembling among the ruins. They were performing a kind of dance of the ghosts, ghosts of a life that had disappeared. And there then followed an extraordinary reading of one of her paintings, in which an ancient symbol of speech is made to cancel out the modern mechanical world. And just to try to show you what I mean, this is a little difficult to see. This is a fragment from a mural painting at Teotihuacan, probably from the 2nd or 3rd century AD. Now, the point is that the little figures who are dancing about, in possibly in a sort of paradise, have scrolls coming out of their mouths, which indicate speech or song or prayer, the emission of air. I'm sorry this is in black and white, but I don't have a colour slide of it. Throughout central Mexico, going back nearly 2,000 years, the wall paintings of Teotihuacan, and continuing in the Mystic and Aztec screenfolds, the sign of speech or song was a curved scroll issuing from the mouth. And Artaud sees this sign, transformed, in Izquierdo's nude with violin. He sees it in the smoke coming out of the chimneys here. And I quote, "An Indian nude sings before an open window, and the clouds of smoke from a nearby factory rise in spirals as if they were coming from the mouth. These volutes are respiration itself, the living breath of the singer. But the canvas draws in a double idea. Maria Izquierdo uses these clouds of smoke that symbolize the machine civilization of Europe as if she would like to cancel them out. She doesn't necessarily," Artaud says, "glimpse all this for herself, but the spirit of the Indian race speaks through her." And I think one might link this to D.H. Lawrence writing in very romantic terms about the revival of a native chief in Mexico. Octavio Paz described Maria Izquierdo as being looking something like a pre-Hispanic goddess, and she didn't object to that at all. She was very happy to be identified with with the indigenous cultures. I'm just showing you this to emphasize the, you can see more clearly the scrolls coming out of the mouths. This is from the Bourbonicus codex. Now, and Izquierdo went on to have a very successful career. This is a typical painting of hers in which she combines still life and landscape. So you see the ruins of a Mexican town, very typical of the post-revolutionary period. These blank, eyeless, windowless walls, contrasting with the extraordinary richness of the squashes and the eggs and the fish in the foreground. She always wanted to have a career as a muralist, but failed. Though she was a feisty person, and she attempted several times to get mural commissions. But I think she's an extremely interesting painter, and needs really more work done on her. Now, I'm now going to start shifting to the wartime period, and I want to talk briefly, more generally, about ruins, starting with this extraordinary essay by Benjamin Perret called Ruins, Ruin of Ruins. This appeared in the final issue of the Surrealist journal Minotaur in Paris in 1939, the same issue as Breton's Souvenir du Mexique and Seligman's Conversation with Tsimshian. And there's a real sense of the impending cataclysm in Europe, of the inevitability of the war that was about to come. And Perret talks about different types of ruins. He's partly inspired, actually, by two things. By the photograph here by Alvarez Bravo of a Mexican ruin, an extraordinary photograph which kind of which turns the ruined arch into a dog, but he was also inspired by photographs, sort of fossilized photographs by Raoul Ubach. Now, the ruins that Perret reproduces there are all of medieval structures, or the Mexican ones, except for the photographs by Ubach, and he talks about medieval ruins as about one set of ruins sort of wiping out another set of ruins. So the medieval ruins form a kind of lava over Roman ruins. He completely ignores what we perhaps are most familiar with in terms of celebrations of ruins from the 17th to the 18th century, such as Piranesi's views of Rome. There's nothing of that kind. There's nothing classical at all in this article. And he ends his article by musing on what kind of spectacle the ruins of our world, modernity, born of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, will leave for the future. And I quote him, "The world that threw Versailles into the common ditch is soon going to disappear in its turn. What ruins will it leave for the exaltation of poets from another age? Neither the churches that have survived the past only as the complement of prisons, nor the banks without which neither of the former would have survived. But perhaps one day they will find again, when its memory will have been effaced from human recall, the gigantic fossil of a unique animal, the Eiffel Tower. Perhaps some great station, long deserted, will see its rails covered in buttercups and hares, leaving their burrows, will seek a home in the abandoned booking office. Perhaps, too, the Grange Batelier, the river, reclaiming its rights, will traverse the opera from wings to entrance, bordered with crests and iris and cross-hatched with kingfishers. And the passerby who walks along it seeking a ford, catching sight of this ruin, bristling with brambles and chirping with birds, will remember that once upon a time they performed silly things for the luxuriously dressed dead, and will say, what a lovely spring, the opera is in flower as never before." And these extraordinary photographs of fossil buildings, this is the Opera, the previous one was the Eiffel Tower by Ubach, were made by a process he called inversion and montage inversion. And the negative is placed on its transparency, while continuously maintaining a slight shifting between the two plates so as to obtain the impression of a slight relief, giving the print the appearance of an impress. So these are kind of fossils, future fossils of buildings. And in a sense, the ruin of the building is matched by the ruin of the photograph and the destruction of the photograph. And I think there's a very interesting study to be made of ruins and the medium, particularly among surrealist artists. Breton linked... The ruins that are overgrown, ruins that are beginning to sink into nature, were an example for Breton of convulsive beauty. And I put up here a quotation from Beauty Will Be Convulsive from Minotaur. "The word convulsive, which I have used to qualify the only beauty that, in my opinion, has any point, would lose all meaning for me were it conceived within movement rather than at the precise expiration of that movement. There can be no beauty, convulsive beauty, except in the affirmation of the reciprocal relationship that links the object in question in movement and at rest. I'm sorry I couldn't use here as illustration the glorious photograph of a locomotive that had been abandoned for years to the delirium of the virgin forest. It seems to me that the magical aspect of this monument to victory and to disaster could have clarified this idea." This is the photograph that he had been hoping to use, which Perret, again, used to illustrate his essay called Nature Devours Progress and, as it were, goes beyond it. And this is the locomotive that was abandoned to the virgin forest. And I think this is another important side of the surrealists' romanticism, was the, in a sense, watching progress, visibly decay. And I think it's interesting to link that to paintings by Max Ernst from the late 20s and early 30s, like this one called The Entire City, in which, I'm not saying it's like Ubach's process of photographic inversion, which produced those curious fossils, but it similarly, as it were, destroys something that has been there before. This is a painting using a grattage technique, that is, he spread a canvas with oil paint, laid it over a textured surface, and then scraped the paint off, producing kind of what he called grattage. And images like this one, which sort of look partly like a ruined city, partly like rocks, and the vegetation in the foreground, as with the locomotive in Perret's photograph, seems to be growing over it. And I think that the notion of the ruin is somehow inscribed through so many surrealist works. Both the ruin of ruins and Breton's essay about Souvenir of Mexico were in the final issue of Minotaur. I'm just showing you the cover, which is by André Masson, which shows you another sort of partial ruin, a labyrinth, which is within the head of the Minotaur. And this is we're coming back to the Coatlicue that I mentioned at the beginning, and which you saw in a small version in one of the early surrealist exhibitions. Breton saw this when he visited Mexico. He probably saw it, for a long time, this is 1885, this is when it was installed outside in the garden of the museum, and here it is in the Salon of Monoliths, where it was until about 1939, and so probably he saw it here. You can see it from the back view in this case. If you look at the head, you can see that the head is the same in the front and the back. It's the head there. There's a skull fastening the serpent belt at the back, and then there's a kind of a tail down the back of it. And here you can see more clearly what I was talking about in relation to the first one, the necklace of hands and hearts, the gap in the middle of the chest where the heart has been removed. And this Coatlicue, this goddess, it's not really a single goddess, it's a whole set of ideas and a complete myth that she that in a sense she encompasses. She was the mother of Huitzilopochtli, a very interesting, another example of parthenogenetic birth. She conceived from a ball of feathers that that appeared in her breast one day, and she gave birth to Huitzilopochtli, who was often associated with the eagle as a sun god. And you can see at the base of the statue, you can see eagle's claws. So it encompasses the whole myth. And this is what Breton actually talks about in Souvenir of Mexico, the poetry. He understood that it was not just, it's not an effigy of a single thing, a figure. It is a complete sort of compilation of myth. The cities like Teotihuacan, which Breton also visited in ruins, were once thought just to be ritual cities, and it's now known that they were actually large, thriving urban districts. I can't say much more about that at this point, but that is an example of what Rubin would call sort of the court society of the pre-Columbian era. And the Cyrillists really took no notice at all of that distinction between the high civilizations and the tribal, so-called tribal areas. Were just as interested in both. This is Seligman's article, Conversation with Tsimshian. Tsimshian is one of the groups in the northwest coast of Canada. And you can see on the right-hand side a photograph. On the left, you've got one of the cemeteries, it's a Nootka cemetery, and on the right, a totem pole that has been abandoned and overgrown. And again, this is an example of a kind of ruin of a ruin. The Cyrillists in Mexico and in New York were actually engaged in quite active ethnographic and literary research. Perret himself was the first to publish a French translation of the Mayan book, the Chilambalam Chumayel, in 1955. And this is a small section. I don't think it's not his translation. I think it's very interesting that he was concerned with literatures, oral stories from the entire continent. By contrast with Claude Lévi-Strauss, who was only interested in masks that came from the non-literary, as it were, but those cultures without writing, without literature. And Perret was interested in both. So he was concerned not with the violent past of America, but its literatures and poetry, so much of which had been lost, and also in the continuing presence of indigenous peoples. He spent years gathering material for his anthology, Myths and Legends of America, Mythes et Légendes d'Amérique, and his letters from the 40s in many collections, begging people to send him material. He wrote to Westphalen in Lima, for example, saying, please send me some of the stories from the Inca and pre-Inca past. This book was finally published the year he died, 1959, but his introduction, written in Mexico, was published by the Cyrillists under the title La Parole est à Perret, it's up to Perret to speak, in New York in 1943. It was considered an essay of central theoretical importance. And there's a double interest in the anthology, which Perret explains, and I quote from the beginning of the introduction. This anthology has as its ambition to represent in its totality, this anthology has no ambition to represent in its totality the literary, primitive, and popular production of the American peoples from pre-Columbian times to the present. It only wants to present as gripping an image as possible of the poetic work of these peoples, by revealing the most characteristic texts dispersed among the chronicles of the conquerors, travellers and missionaries on the one hand, and in the work of ethnologists and folklorists on the other. There is no intention of trampling on the domain of the ethnographer, because the only criterion that has governed the choice of text for this anthology is that of poetry. And this mode of selection shows clearly that poetic thought has been present since the dawn of humanity. Birds fly, fish swim, and man invents. For, alone in nature, he is gifted with an imagination always alert, always stimulated by constantly renewed needs. So he talks about the way it's the human imagination that has constructed the great collective myths of the past in all kinds of different religious, technological, and social conditions, in societies nomadic, hunter-gatherer, and agricultural and urban. And Perret's other theme is the absence of myth in the contemporary world, and the miserable existence to which the mass of the population is reduced today, remote from any poetic thought, although the need for poetry is still latent. And I think that the notion that there might be a new myth in formation is something that grips the surrealists, both those in New York who were writing the magazine VVV and those in Mexico. This is one of the masks that was in André Breton's collection from the Northwest Coast. It's an extraordinary combination of face and fish. It might have sort of shamanic meaning. Many of the masks did. That is, they referred to a particular relationship between man and animal, that the man could take on some of the power and the potential of an animal, could move between them. Very often the masks are to do with asking for help with hunting, help with fishing. It's now in the Quai Branly. And the other, one of the other areas that the Surrealists collected were the Kachina dolls from the southern United States, from the Hopi areas of New Mexico. This is one of them. This belonged to Max Ernst, I think, and photographed by Berenice Abbott. And this is one from Breton's collection, with a postcard on the right-hand side, with a key to the symbols that are painted on the Kachina dolls. And he was interested to find out more about them. He wasn't just sort of dazzled by the extraordinary evidence of the human imagination. In Mexico, Wolfgang Parlin, who had also moved there from Europe, started a magazine called DIN, D-Y-N, which he thought of as a kind of, post-surrealist. I mean, and he wanted to start a new movement, which he called DIN, after dynamism. And he wrote A Farewell to Surrealism. It's rather vague and high-flown, but he has the idea. I think he considers that surrealism is not actually sufficiently interested in scientific discoveries, and it's turning too much towards a mystical interest in the world. This is an example of one of Parlin's paintings, in which he attempted to capture something of a sort of vigour of the invisible physical energy in the world. So there was a kind of rivalry and split between DIN and the New York magazines VVV and View. But after the war, Parlin became close again to the Surrealists. And the photograph on the left I've taken from the post-war magazine Medium, which shows Parlin leaning against one of the great Olmec heads in Veracruz. And you can see two other photographs by archaeologists on the right-hand side, showing one of these heads in the process of excavation. And they are enormous size. Now, one very interesting thing about the story of the archaeology of Middle America is that at this date in the 1940s, there was considerable disagreement about who the Olmec were. The North American archaeologists said that they were a late offshoot of the Maya, that they dated from sometime post 800 AD. The Mexican archaeologists said, no, they're actually much earlier than that. These are remains that go back to 800 BC, 1000 BC. And there was a large round table meeting, I think 1943, and eventually evidence was brought forward to prove that indeed the Mexicans were right, and the Olmec, as they were known, though we don't know what they're really called, were actually the first, as it were, the first great organized civilization in Mexico. DIN devoted one of its issues to the Amerindian cultures. This is the cover, and it included some wonderful photographs of Inca architecture, which Moro commissioned from the photographer Martin Chambi, and it shows you one of these stone buildings are constructed with extraordinary precision and brilliance. And not using any concrete or any kind of filling at all. And that's the stone... Sorry. This stone here has so many angles in it that it provides an extraordinary stable centre for these walls, which actually, on the whole, don't fall down in earthquakes. This is another pair of photographs of Sacsayhuaman at the top. And these were accompanied by an article by Moro celebrating the Inca architecture of the immediate pre-Spanish period. And I think they were also one of the influences on the painter I'm going to finish with, Gunter Gerzo, who was working in Mexico. Now, so this is now coming to an end. This is a work by Gunter Gerzo, who has been almost exclusively exhibited and commented upon in the context of Mexican 20th century art, and within that as a pioneer of abstraction. Risking the Abstract, Mexican Modernism and the Art of Gunter Gerzo is the title of the largest exhibition so far dedicated to his work. And Gerzo was born in Mexico in 1915, spent much of his youth in Switzerland, was a stage designer in Cleveland, Ohio, returning to Mexico frequently. In 1941, he finally settled there, working as a set designer during the golden age of Mexican cinema for the surrealist Luis Buñuel, among others, and he was painting his spare time. He finally dedicated himself to painting in 1962, and he always denied his paintings were purely abstract. People have said, "I'm an abstract painter." I believe my paintings are very realistic. They're real because they express precisely who I am. Today, still, I am a surrealist. What I do is a species of abstract surrealism. Now, his early paintings very frankly announced their surrealist influences, like this one. This is a very violent painting called El Descuartizado, or The Quartered. And this was reproduced in VVV in February 1944. And like Masson's paintings of this period, it fragments figures and creatures, minotaurs, horns, claws, bones in a landscape. This is a painting by Gerzo of the of a little group of surrealists in Mexico City. Eleanor Carrington, who is the half-naked figure raised up on the left, Remedios Varo wearing a mask, and Perret himself and Gerzo. It's a little anecdotal picture. Gerzo shared the surrealist passion for the art and architecture of pre-Columbian America. In Mexico, like his friend, the artist and caricaturist Miguel Covarrubias, he collected carvings and pottery figures from Totilco, and you can see them here. They're from Veracruz, I think, these ones. Underneath the painting, his painting that's called Apparition. And I think it was the buildings of pre-conquest America that had the most profound impact on Goetze's painting. He visited the... there is apparition again. I should just say that this painting is not slashed like a Fontana. The whole thing is painted. The whole thing is an illusion. Goetze visited the old cities like Labna and Chichen Itza, naming paintings after them. And he also used photographs such as those by Chambi that we saw just now. And it wasn't just the structures of these walls and buildings that fascinated Goetze, but the tragic past and hidden present of indigenous America, of which they are dumb witnesses. I'll just quote the first line of a poem by Perret called The Swirl of Dust, which was written in Mexico. And Perret put this sense of the pain of the dead past when stones slam their doors as a sign of despair. And this is a photograph that he certainly knew. It's by another of the surrealist group called Eva Sulzer, and it's of the Great Pyramid at the ruined Maya city of Uxmal. It's a dark photograph that the temple is darkly framed and with unyielding shadows at its entrance. And Goetze once said to Rita Ada, "When you try to look into one of my paintings, you'll always run into a wall that keeps you from going any further. It will stop you with the brilliance of its light, but at the back there's a black plane. It's fear. Fear of what? Of the dark? Of ghosts? Of the past? Of the dead and their ruins? Or of a repressed, supposedly archaic present that confronts modern Latin America at every turn?" The book that most brilliantly captures this fear, which Mexican intellectuals represented as a metaphysical threat, is The Labyrinth of Solitude by Goetze's close friend, the poet, critic, and surrealist Octavio Paz. The ambiguity at the heart of The Labyrinth of Solitude is between we, the modern Mexicans seeking to forge a fully modern society, and they, peasants, Indians. And I quote, "We struggle against imaginary entities, vestiges of the past that we've engendered. Those ghosts and vestiges are real, at least for us. Those ghosts are the vestiges of past realities. They originated in the conquest, the colony. The peasants are remote, slightly archaic in their manner of dressing and speaking, since, for everyone except for themselves, they embody the occult, the hidden, ancient wisdom, hidden in the folds of the earth." Paz romanticizes the bitter reality of an indigenous present, incommensurable, he believes, with the former civilizations, those who built Uxmal, Sacsayhuaman, etc. But in his circulatory poem, he suggested that surrealism helped Latin America to come to terms with an overlaying of eras, with a coexistence of pasts and presents that refused to conform to the normal given periodizations of history. And I quote from Paz's poem, "Surrealism passed, will pass through Mexico, far away in Mexico, not this one, the other, ever buried, ever living." Thank you.